My name is Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a member of the West Side Men's Group. Thank you. We'd like to welcome you all to our first ever, hopefully first annual West Side Men's Group breakfast. From all the group members, we do consider it a privilege to have the opportunity to serve you fine folks this morning. It really is an honor for us that you would take the time to get up out of bed early on a Saturday morning and come and support us, considering, I know for some of you, not too long ago, this is my wife included, you wouldn't have gotten up early on a Saturday morning to let us back in the house, much less supporting our cause. But anyway, what really, really amazes me is that any of you would be willing to eat anything that this crew is going to cook for you. And I'm not kidding. We're not talking about the most domesticated bunch of people here. I was there when the idea for this West Side Men's Group breakfast was born. It was just a group of us sitting around. One of our group members, Johnny G, he's back there on the serving line in the middle in the tie. And he's one of our needier group members. And I don't mean needy in the monetary sense. You know, he's been sober for a while. He earns a decent wage, I assume. But I'm talking about needy in the sense that, John kind of fancies himself aristocratic of sorts, of imperial upbringing, perhaps. You know, privileged. Considers himself one that likes to be pampered. If there were still servants in today's society, he'd have him a couple. You know the kind of guy I'm talking about. So we're sitting around dinner, and he says, I think we should have a West Side Men's Group breakfast. And I'm thinking, this guy has never successfully cooked an Eggo waffle in his life, much less preparing breakfast for 300 people. And then Armin, another one of our beloved group members, you'll get a chance to meet him a little later, he chimes in with, yes, John, that would be a lovely idea. Now, where is Armin? You'll get to meet him a little later. There he is. Martha Stewart, Armin is not. This guy lives by the magical clothes hamper theory, where you just sort of toss your dirty skivvies in the corner at night, and then miraculously the next day they ended up laundered and folded in the top left drawer. This guy has got one of those pop-up coffee tables that converts into a dining room table so that you never, ever have to leave your couch. I mean, you just lay there all day long. Mary, get me another turkey pot pie. Just lounging out. And these guys want to cook breakfast for 300 people. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. You know, but alas, here we all are. And I got to tell you, it is amazing. We all got here between 5 and 6 in the morning and started setting up this room. And it's really neat to look around at a group of recovering alcoholics from all walks of life. I think we were 18 to 80 years old. We've got a couple of days sober, up to over 30 years sober. And it really is amazing seeing all these guys getting together to pull this thing off. Actually, I should say try to pull this thing off. We're about 5 minutes into it. We've got a lot of room for error. But we do have a professional chef on our staff. It's Chris C. I don't see him right now, but he does this for a living. If any of you are Seinfeld fans, you know the soup Nazi. That's Chris. He even sort of looks like the soup Nazi. So my recommendation is keep moving through the line, keep the special orders to a minimum, and we should be okay. But he's really outdone himself. We've got a beautiful menu prepared for you tonight. We're starting off with a lovely Israeli flatbread drizzled with extra virgin olive oil and some Moroccan sesame seeds. We're then going to transition into a beautiful pan-roasted pheasant with the rosemary fig chutney. That's accompanied with a potato and goat cheese terrine with a fresh basil and oven-roasted tomatoes. It's lovely. Then we have some beautiful hand-squeezed Hawaiian passion fruit and pineapple juice for you tonight. Well, hold on. What's that? No. Sorry about that. Forget that. We're having scrambled eggs and whole wheat toast. I guess I shouldn't have missed that last planning meeting. My mistake, guys. Anyway, it looks like everybody's lined up and we're getting ready to get this thing started, so we're going to try to move you through the buffet at an orderly pace. We're going to offer Mr. Cherry Pie the first plate tonight. He's our honored speaker, so we're going to move him through. But in the second table, I think we're going to make a decision on who gets to eat next with a little trivia question. We'll go with some sports trivia. Whoever can name the starting pitcher for the Yankees in tonight's game, their table. I heard Andy Pettit from. I'm sorry, sir. That's incorrect. The correct response is, who cares? Marlins win in six. Yeah. Your table will eat last. All right, we're going to move you through in an orderly fashion. I'd like to invite the table to begin, and then we'll start off with the table right here in the middle. If you would all like to, we've got buffets on either side of the room, so please just proceed up. Start at the far end and work your way back. This table may go. You guys may go. This table may also go. Again, my name is Brad, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the West Side Men's Group. All, please join me for a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, one of our fellow members, the little lamb Eric, is going to come up and tell us about the AA preamble.
Hello, my name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic. Eric. Member of the West Side Men's Group. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve the common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, institution, does not wish to any engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others recover from alcoholism. Thank you.
Another of our founding group members is going to come up and give you guys just a little history on the West Side Men's Group. We have Kansas Bill for you.
My name's Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here and be sober today, and really honored to be a part of this first inaugural breakfast. I'm supposed to give a group history. I'm going to call this not necessarily a history, but a little bit of the growth of a group, because that's, I think, what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about growth. My case, spiritual growth. Back in June of 2001, there was a group of us that, as we do often, got together up at the Cynical Retreat House for the Growing in Sobriety Retreat, a men's retreat. And on Saturday night, after 24 hours in that retreat, there were three of us that I think were experiencing what always happens when we go up there, and that is the spiritual lifting of our hearts and souls. And what we were doing was sitting in the Rose Garden at the Cynical Retreat House, and we were talking about how grateful we were. We were talking about how lucky we were. Now, I've heard it said often that all you need is a resentment and a coffee pot, and you can start your own meeting. But that's not the way this one started. It started with gratitude. And that started, those discussions started in June of 2001. John and Armin and I were just talking about all of the great things that had happened to us since the previous retreat. The next day, we all jumped in Don's car, and on the way back down, we started talking about it with Don and getting his advice and his counsel on whether we should start our own men's meeting. I was against specialty meetings. I wanted to fight against a men's meeting. I lost out on that, and you know, I guess that's one of the things that is about growth. You live and you learn, and I think it was the right decision for us. A lot of times people give their sobriety date when they're up here. I'm not going to do that. I'll tell you that that for me, October is my sobriety month. And 2 days ago, I had the privilege of celebrating 5,500 days of sobriety. Now, I don't know if that impresses you at all, but I know that God's miracles impress me a lot, and that's exactly what that is. That's a miracle of God. And so was October 18th of 2001, and that's when the first meeting of the Westside Men's Group happened. There were 10 of us there. We met outside at the pavilion at the St. Gregory's Catholic Church. The topic that night was life and acceptance. We also held our first business meeting that night and elected some of the officers of the group. The next week, I don't know who proposed the idea or where they stole it from, but we created our first men's group list, phone list, and I'm happy to say that that phone list is surviving today and is doing quite well. We hand it out to anybody that comes to our meeting that wants it. In July of 2002, as you can imagine, by July, meeting outside was starting to get a little uncomfortable. It was a little soggy out there and a little warm. Prior to that, we had started talking about where we were going to go. Plantation United Methodist Church was gracious enough to offer us their library. And on July 11th of 2002, we moved into the library, which is in the building right next door. Prior to that time, the meeting had been about 10 to 12 people on a regular basis. When we moved inside, the meeting really took off, and we went probably close to 25 guys within the next month, and wasn't long after that that we were into the 30s. November 12th of 2002, GSO sent us a letter and gave us official notice that we were an official group, that we were a registered group, which I think is important. This group is one of our missions besides spiritual growth is to support the AA community, both here in locally, and as you know, the proceeds from this breakfast this morning will go to our intergroup office, and so we also are a registered group at GSO, and we want to provide for them as well. In April of 2003, we had outgrown the library, and we moved to the men or to the fellowship hall, which is in the back room back here. At that point, we had reached, on average, in the high 30s, 38, 39 guys every week. We moved into a bigger room, and the meeting just, you know, kind of popped up again, another 10, 12 guys. We were constantly in the 40s, and we've hit 50s a few times. That's the physical growth of the meeting. And what you've heard is some of the history. The history is what you can put in black and white on a piece of paper. The growth of the meeting is things like an inaugural breakfast. It's things like a phone list. It's things like supporting our intergroup and local areas. And, you know, 5,500 days is a neat number, right? It's a cool number, but, you know, that's just one. You know, this month, Alan celebrated 21 years of sobriety. That's a neat number. And in that sense, we celebrate the history of AA. But probably more impressive to me than 5,000 and some days and 21 is that John and I were just talking a few minutes ago. We've had five guys in the last year pick up one-year medallions that started out in this group. Five guys. You know, that to me is the growth. That is the future of AA and the future of the Westside Men's Group. And that to me is the point at which I am the proudest today. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Another Bill, Boston Bill, is going to come up and talk to us about the 12 steps.
I know it. Good morning. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober today through the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and through the 12 Steps of Recovery. And when this was asked of me, what I wanted to do was just kind of give a very brief background of the 12 Steps, and you'll see what a miracle they were when they came about. This actually started in May of 38 when they started writing the big book, and by December of 38, now you can imagine there wasn't any cell phones, no TV, you know, things were a little bit different then. And in December of 38, they had actually put together 6 steps. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a brief reading. It's going to be about a page and a half that'll just kind of encapsulate what these 12 steps are all about, where they came from. It starts out with Bill speaking. I was in anything but a spiritual mood on the night when the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were written. I was sore, tired, clear through. I lay in bed at 182 Clinton Street with pencil in hand and with a tablet of scratch paper on my knee. I could not get my mind on the job, much less put my heart in it. But here was one of those things that had to be done. Slowly my mind came into some kind of focus. Since Abby's visit to me in the fall of 1934, we had gradually evolved what we call the word-of-mouth program. Most of the basic ideas had come from the Oxford groups, William James and Dr. Silkworth. Though subject to considerable variation, it all boiled down into a pretty consistent procedure, which comprised 6 steps. Now, I'm going to skip a little bit here only because I want to keep to the point. But all of us, East and West, were placing increasing emphasis on Dr. Silkworth's expression describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus the allergy. By now we knew from experience that the new prospect had to accept step 1 or get no place. This particular evening, as my mind ran over these developments, it seemed to me that the program was still not definite enough. It might be a long time before readers of the book in distant places and lands could be personally contacted. Therefore, our literature would have to be as clear and comprehensive as possible. Our steps would have to be more explicit. There must not be a single loophole through which the rationalizing alcoholic could wiggle out. Maybe our 6 chunks of truth should be broken into smaller pieces. Thus, we could better get the distant reader over the barrel, and at the same time, we might be able to broaden and deepen the spiritual implications of our whole presentation. So far as I can remember, this was all I had in mind when the writing began. Finally, I started to write. I set out to draft more than 6 steps. How many more, I did not know. I relaxed and asked for guidance. With a speed that was astonishing, considering my jangling emotions, I completed the first draft. It took perhaps half an hour. Imagine that, a half an hour. The words kept right on coming. When I reached the stopping point, I numbered the new steps. They added up to 12. Somehow, this number seemed significant. Without any special rhyme or reason, I connected them with the 12 apostles. Feeling greatly relieved now, I commenced to reread the draft. At this moment, a couple of late callers arrived. One of them was my boon companion of those days, Howard A. With him was a newcomer, dry barely 3 months. I was greatly pleased with what I had written, and I read them the new version of the program, now the 12 Steps. Howard and his friend reacted violently. Why 12 steps, they demanded. And then they got, you've got too much God in these steps. You will scare people away. And what do you mean by getting those drunks down on their knees when they are asked to have all their shortcomings removed? And who wants to have the shortcomings removed anyhow? As they saw my uneasiness, Howard added, well, some of this stuff does sound pretty good after all, but Bill, you've got to tone it down. It's too stiff. The average alcoholic just won't buy it the way it stands. I sprang to defense of my new creation, every single word of it. A terrific discussion developed when Lois turned up a couple of hours later. Why don't you forget about it for a while, she said, and have a cup of coffee, and this we did. And so the history began of this. And when you think about that, when this man sat down for half an hour and put these steps together, you know, it's absolutely amazing. And he was just, he was in his fifth year of sobriety. Now imagine that, you know, here I've been here a lot of years, and a lot of times I shut off to people that have been here 5, 10 years, 15 years, because I think I know too much. And yet here's a man that wrote these steps in his fifth year. So it's absolutely amazing. So now I will read the 12 steps. Step one, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. There has not been no other document in the history of mankind that has ever been able to keep man sober as this has. This is responsible for the sobriety and continued sobriety of millions and millions of people. And it still works today as it did in 1938 when it was written by a man that was 5 years sober and he wrote them in a half an hour. So it's absolutely a God-given program. Thank you.
Just as we have 12 steps, we also have 12 traditions. Excuse me, and another one of our group members, Brian, is going to come and tell us about the 12 traditions.
Hi, group. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June 21st, 1989. We have so much to be grateful for, being members of Alcoholics Anonymous and not suffering the way we once all suffered. And I have a lot to be grateful for. I'm new to this area, and they asked me to participate in this day. And here in my 14th year, and talk about the traditions. A little blurb on the traditions and then read them to you guys. And we think it was in our 15th year of being an organization, being a unified group, that our founder saw as a result of what was going on around the country and letters he was receiving, that we needed some spiritual principles put down onto paper that could guide us as groups so we didn't destroy each other. And at the time previous to that in Texas, you actually had to pay to come show up. And where I lived in Washington, D.C., you were actually asked the question of whether what political sect you were a part of. We have a joke where I came from in that way. Outside of Cleveland, There was a definite distinction on how religious you were, and I'm not going to go into all the different qualifications. There's a little peer pressures added to this. And I found this information out from my grand sponsor, who was a part of GSO for over 20 years. And so many little blurbs get around, not just the old-timers, get around the early-timers. The old-timers know who the early-timers are. They supersede all of us. They were the guys that and gals that ran with Bill, ran with Bob. They're the ones that helped formulate Alcoholics Anonymous and helped formulate the ideas that were being thrown around, like we throw around ideas in our clubs and houses and our meetings. Well, they were throwing around the ideas that came to be our traditions and later to be our concepts. And I'm so grateful because I found a group here, this men's group, the Westside Men's Group, that abides by the traditions. And you can feel it when you walk into the meeting. And you can feel a meeting that abides by the traditions and ones that don't. And in a meeting that abides by the traditions, they uphold a primary purpose to carry the message to the new guy. And also to maybe the suffering old guy. And their objective is to stay the course of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're not here to get psychotherapy. We're not here to help each other with drugs. And we're not here to help each other with sex. And we might have problems with other issues, but we're here to stay the course to alcoholism. And I respect that. That's why I chose to become a part of this group, because you can feel it. It's in the beat of the meeting. And I'm so grateful for that, and I hope you feel good about your meetings in the same way. So after 15 years, Bill put together our traditions, and we have 12 of them. We seem to run with the theme of 12 in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you haven't caught that yet. But we're going to go ahead and describe and read the 12 traditions to you. And the first one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Least problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should forever remain non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
And now one of our founding members, Armin, is going to introduce our guest speaker this evening. Armin.
Hi, my name's Armin. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a member of this group, Westside Men's Group. While I'm going over the next brief part of the program, Andy and his team are going to pass the baskets, the results of which will also benefit Intergroup. So, the first thing that I'd like to do is just thank all the guys who volunteered to put this breakfast together. Brad, yeah, please. Brad described how the idea came about in kind of an animated way when he was up here, but I can tell you that a lot of what it was really based on was the Miami Men's Group, who has a very successful breakfast that supports the Dade County area every January, and a lot of us think a lot of that group and think a lot of that breakfast, and we want to emulate them, you know, because we want to copy the winners, you know, and that's definitely a group that is full of winners. And Larry Cartwright was a former member of the group, and he's now a member of our group, and he's brought that experience into our group, and that's helped us grow. So we also want to thank the Plantation United Methodist Church, you know, because this church has been a great friend to us. When we needed a place to meet, they offered it to us as a community service. They didn't ask us for a donation. We make a donation quarterly as in accordance with our seventh tradition, but they didn't ask for one. They wanted to just give us a place to have a meeting as a community service. So, and now I get to the good part. This is the good part. And I know Pete's been waiting a while to speak, so I'm going to get him up here. But when we were putting this breakfast together, first thing we needed was a speaker committee. And I pushed and shoved to get to the front of the line because I wanted to be the chairperson of that committee. And it's because I can reveal my agenda now. I had one man and one man only in mind, you know. I went through the whole protocol of pretending like I was looking at other speakers, but all along the line I wanted Pete, you know. And the reason that I wanted Pete is because I know a few key things about him, which I will tell you. My first sponsor, Mark, once told me that Pete was the first man that he thought of as his sponsor. He ended up getting another sponsor, but I know Mark's program, and the fact that he would consider Pete told me a lot about Pete. That was the first thing I knew about him. The second thing I knew about him was seeing him in action in AA. You know, the meetings that I would go to, the people that I knew that knew him, this guy worked the program. You know, he wasn't just talking the program. I heard about the things he did, and I heard about the actions that he took, and that impressed me. The third thing that impressed me about Pete was once I heard his story and I heard where he came from, my ears heard one thing and my eyes saw another thing, and that told me that AA has a magical transformation power, which I was just beginning to experience in my life, but which by looking at guys like Pete and Mark and Stu and guys that had more sobriety, I knew that it worked because I saw what they came from and I saw where they were today, you know. And then finally, I had the privilege of hearing Pete speak up at Lake Bird in 95. And there are some things he said in that talk which I have carried with me since then, and actually I have regurgitated as my own original ideas many times. But, you know, that's how AA works. But he impressed me, and I have a tape of that talk, and I listen to that tape many times a year because it's a good, solid, old-school AA talk. And I know that tonight, when you're done listening to Pete, you're going to know that you got a good, solid, old-school AA talk. So help me welcome Pete C. from Fort Lauderdale.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name's Pete Cherry, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank you, Armin, so much for inviting me, and I'd like to thank the committee, you know, and above all, I'd like to thank God for this opportunity. So many Saturday mornings I woke up in Broward County Jail. So many Saturday mornings I woke up in Broward General Hospital, recovering from gunshot wounds. I was the type of alcoholic that the alcoholics didn't want to be with. Mean, evil, and nasty, and didn't care, ladies and gentlemen. The gentleman that was speaking up here before me said he didn't want to say his sobriety day, but mine is March the 28th, 1980. Feel so good to be here, so good. I had my family with me, my granddaughter, my wife. My wife had to step out. I guess she must have had to smoke or something, you know what I mean? Yeah, you guys. But I came to tell you that alcohol took me to a lot of movies that I didn't want to see. Took me places I didn't want to go. Made me do things I didn't want to do. Made me stay longer than I wanted to stay. Made me pay a price I didn't want to pay. But March the 28th, 1980, I got, well, I guess, one of the greatest gifts that God can restore on a human being. I got my life back. When a man or woman loses their self-respect, that's about as low as you can go. And I got to that point, ladies and gentlemen. You know, most men and women, when they pass a mirror or a showcase or something like that, you like to look at your reflection, you know, and check yourself out. But I got to the point that I didn't want to see that reflection in the mirror. I was ashamed of the man that I saw in the mirror because of the things that I did in my life. My drinking started off in the state of Georgia. Moonshine. Yeah. Moonshine capital of the world, you know. And it followed me down to Florida, and I drank during, oh, man, high school. You know, I need to tell you this. I drank during high school, and my graduation night, I was drunk. And after I graduated from high school, I graduated from Dillard High in Fort Lauderdale. And at the time, I was fortunate enough. I could have went to any school in this country that would take a black man at that time on an athletic scholarship. But I had other ideas. I wanted to party, and that's what I did. I partied so much, ladies and gentlemen, I became homeless in this town with a mother and a grandmother in Fort Lauderdale. And something that I like to tell people was a proud part of my life. Once in my life, my mom had the city of Fort Lauderdale Police Department take me away from the house. And she said in front of a bunch of those officers, you know, we were neighborhood officers, we all grew up together, and a lot of these guys turned out to be police officers. I want you guys to make sure he never come near me again. And one of the sergeants there knew me very well, and he said, Pete, you heard what the lady said. If one of my men called me and tell me they thought they saw you in this area, you're going to be in bad shape. That was something that I lived with for a long time in the back of my mind, you know, not seeing my mom. It bothered me real bad, you know, especially on holidays. It's getting close to the Christmas time, you know, and all the guys and the girls would be talking about having dinner with their parents, you know, and their family and stuff like that. And I was never invited. And it used to make me feel so bad. And today I always say, boy, you're in bad shape when a man or woman in America, you doesn't get a Christmas card or a Christmas gift for Christmas. And I also like to say, boy, when you ain't got a toothbrush or a door key, you're in bad shape. I've been in all those positions due to my drinking. Very disrespectful, you know. A man that was just terrorizing everybody, just determined to live his own life, his own way, and do his own things. I didn't respect anybody, and that was including the Broward Sheriff's deputies. You know, I was very disrespectful to those men and women in the city of Fort Lauderdale Police Department. I went to jail a lot of times, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of times. You heard me say, when I came here this morning, the gentleman was sitting at the door there, you know, was taking collections and giving out tickets, and he said, you're the speaker, you know, come on in. No, let me pay for my family. Boy, because it is a thrill to wake up on Saturday morning and have some money. Let me pay. It's a thrill to wake up on Saturday morning and have. I'm still grateful. I haven't had a drink of booze in a little over 23 years. And I am still grateful, ladies and gentlemen, the things that happened in my life. I'm living today better than I ever lived in my life. I'm a homeowner, huh? I got a new truck. My wife got the first SUV, and she wouldn't let me drive it. You know what I mean? So I had to go get me one. You know, I went and got me one of them big Dodge Durangos, you know? And my life today is so unbelievable. I still do this after all these years. I still do this. I lay in the bed and just cry because I feel so good. I don't want to drink. I don't want to beat my wife. Huh? I don't want to steal anything, and I don't have to lie anymore. I lied so much I would get angry with you because you wouldn't believe my lies. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Huh? Get angry with a person. You're telling them a lie, and you get angry with the person because they won't believe the lie. Huh? That was my lifestyle. Could I have that cup of water, please? And that was my lifestyle. But today, March 28, 1980, I went to a man. The reason how I knew about this man, he had tried to help my two brothers. I lost two brothers to this disease, ladies and gentlemen, 133 and 137. And I went to this man and asked this man for help. And this man said something at the time. I really didn't know what he mean. I was just saying, yeah, I was just desperate for some help. But the way all of this started was I terrorized the neighborhood one day. I terrorized the whole neighborhood. Oh, God, I had must be 100 people or more, and including 25 or 30 of the city of Fort Lauderdale Police Department looking for me for what I did. And that was March the 28th, 1980. Something happened on that day. I like to say this, ladies and gentlemen. Something happened on that day. I had heard of these things, but had never experienced them. I've heard people say they heard voices. And I always thought you know, you're a few bricks short of a load if you heard voices, you know what I mean? I heard a voice running from the cops, hiding out, trying to go to a man to get some money to keep drinking. I heard a voice. And it came from an old wrecked car on the side of the street. And it said, Pete, you're an alcoholic, you need some help. You're an alcoholic and you need some help. And I say, who said that? And I went over to the car, and it was just the shell of a car, just the body. No engine, no tires, nothing, and it's sitting flat on the ground. And I heard it again. I said, you're an alcoholic, you need some help. That changed my plans. I didn't get the money that I was going after. I went to this man. I knew where this man's office was, and I went in and asked him for help. And he said something at the time. I didn't know what it meant. I just said, yeah. He said, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And I just said, yes. And he was the one that carried me to the Bark Detox. And also in that Bark Detox, I have a meeting now, ladies and gentlemen. I've been on the institution committee in Broward County for 22 years. I've been taking that meeting in the Bark Detox on Sunday night, every other Sunday night. And when I got in that detox, that's where my life, things started to happen to me that had never happened before. The first thing happened to me when I got into that detox was the lady gave me a pair of pajamas, had little smiley faces all over. She gave me a pair of rubber slippers. She gave me a toothbrush and a throwaway razor, a washcloth, and a towel, and a little bar of soap. And she said, go in the bathroom there, shower yourself up, clean yourself up. And I went in the bathroom. And in this bathroom, every time someone would come in, the door would produce pressure, and you could hear the air seep behind you, and you would automatically look. And I'm sitting there. When I laid this stuff out, I was just sitting there just staring at the soap, the towel, and the washcloth. And a guy came in and said, is something wrong with you? And I said, what do you mean? He said, tell me why you standing there staring at the washcloth, the soap, and the towel, and stuff like that. And I said, because I don't own one. And he said, man, you were in bad shape, weren't you? You didn't have a toothbrush and a towel? And I said, no, and I didn't have a door key either. That's the part I was telling you about earlier, ladies and gentlemen, that alcohol take you to a lot of movies that you don't want to see. Well, it took me there. And after I'd taken a shower in that detox, ladies and gentlemen, I started to itch so bad. I'm like that, and some other people told me that they were like that too. If you don't take a shower or bath on a regular basis, after a long period of time, once you do take one, you'll start to itch. And these nurses in this detox started to put all this medication, powder and medication all over me to stop me. And at one point, I thought about leaving. And the lady said, Pete, you can do this. It's going to go away. You can do this. And in that detox, for the first time in my life, I started to listen to another human being. They told me one of the requirements for being in there is I must attend all the AA meetings that they had there, you know. And no problem. And I was going to, and they would come around and tell you what time the meeting start. And the lady was calling everybody, meeting time, meeting time. And what room to go in. And I went to the room, and I got there early, and I was standing in the door. And when the man and the lady, it was two men and a lady, was bringing the meeting in. They were in charge of the meeting. They was the chairman. One of the men passed by me, and the man had on some real good-smelling cologne. I had been drunk so long that I had lost sight on reality. I had forgot about men wore cologne, you know. That's how drunk I was. That's what alcohol had erased a lot of things from my mind and from my memory. I lost it. And as they spoke, and, you know, the men and the women, I noticed the man had on a nice watch and ring, you know. And every watch and ring that I had had, I'd sold it or pawned it. I didn't have anything. And I would sit there. And I got to the point where when the lady would say, it's meeting time, she said, you something. I said, what's that? She said, we haven't had a client like you that I can remember. When we say meeting time, you head immediately for the meeting room. You know, because what was happening in those meetings, ladies, you know, these men and women was telling my story. It was like I thought they followed me around and recorded all of this and was just reciting it. You know what I mean? Because they were telling my story about how they went to jail and how they got drunk and how they lost their self-respect. And one guy in particular, he came in there. And this man said that he had been shot 4 or 5 times. After the meeting, I talked with him. And I said, I don't know if you believe it or not. I've been shot more than that. And he said, it's possible. He said, it's possible. When you drink alcohol and you lose respect for yourself and other people, a lot of bad things happen to you. But it's a man in the program some of you all might know named Maury. Maury and a group of guys was bringing a meeting into that detox. And one of the guys said something. Now, why this got my attention and why it stayed in my mind, at the time I didn't know, but today I do know. He said all Alcoholics Anonymous was asking for me was to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and not take a drink. And he reassured me that they wasn't going to pour all the booze in the ocean in 90 days, and they ain't going to burn up all the coke and all the reefer in 90 days. So whatever you're taking, if you stay away from it 90 days and you want to go back, hey, man, it's kind of deal. If you don't like it at the end of the 90th day, go back, baby. And that was like a replay machine in my head over and over, 90 meetings in 90 days without a drink. And ladies and gentlemen, when I got ready to be dismissed from this place, I had worked a few hours, I don't know, like 2 or 3 hours. And the guy that I worked for found out where I was, brought the money over there, and he wouldn't tell me. They wouldn't tell me the money was there. But when I got ready to release, they gave me the money. I opened that envelope, and here's a drunk. They had a drink in 6 days, and it was $3 $10 bills in that envelope. Immediately, the mind, huh? This disease centers in the mind, not in the body. In the mind was where it started. $30, 6 days. And I walked about a block from where the detox were, and I could see the sign on a package store. And it looked like that sign had fingers on it, you know. Come on down, huh? But still, again, that replay machine in my head went off. 90 meetings in 90 days without a drink. So I was smoking at the time. And I went to this store and I bought a carton of cigarettes, a six-pack of soda, a big, thick pack of lunch meat, and a loaf of bread. And I went back, ladies and gentlemen, to where I was staying at the time, and that was one of the most horrible sights you ever want to see. I was living in a wooden building on 6th Avenue down behind the old Pepsi-Cola plant, and it had rats all in the building. I had a mattress, a sheet, and a blanket. An old pillow in there. I hadn't been there in 6 days. And there were rat droppings all over the bed. This is where I got to sleep. And I know today I said the magic words. And I remember those very well. I said, God, I don't want to live like this anymore. I shook the blankets and the sheet and the mattress and all that stuff and turned it over. Ate me a sandwich. And went to sleep. Very shortly after that, I went to work on a regular basis. Now, I had a job all this time, ladies and gentlemen, being homeless, believe me. I had a job. And it's truly amazing why this company never fired me. Here's a man who worked 10 hours, 15 hours. One guy said, they was afraid of you. Everybody else in town was afraid of you. They probably was afraid of you, too. Yeah? About 6 months of sobriety, this boss called me one day, told me to come in the back office. Once you went in the back office, he had two offices, an outer office and a back office. If you were in trouble, he would invite you in the back office. He would never let other people hear him get on your case. So when the guy told me, he said, the boss said, come in the back office, he asked me, what did you do? And I said, I don't do nothing. He said, well, he told me to tell you to come in the back office. So I said, well, if you want to start something, I'm sober. I'll just walk out, just quit. When I went back there, that man had one of these big old thick time books, and he showed me in that time book about my drinking. Every week I'd have 10 hours, 15 hours. I used to get 30 once in a while, huh? But you can see in that book where I got sober, it was 40 hours, 40 hours, 40 hours. He handed me my check. And he said, today you don't owe me any more money. It's the first time in 10 years your loan with me has been paid out. I said, boy, oh boy. Those people in Alcoholics Anonymous might know what they're talking about. I wasn't very sure at that time. But then a few weeks later, I got a phone call. And when the guy said, you got a phone call, I said, no, Nobody calls me. Don't try to fool me. We played a lot of practical jokes. I'm not going and pick up the phone. So just get away from me. So the owner came out and he said, did he tell you what I said? I said, yes, he did. And I'm telling you the same thing. I'm not coming to pick up that phone. He says, someone on the phone needs to talk to you. And I say, who? He said, well, why don't you pick up the phone and find out who it is? I say, okay, you listen to this. You own this company. But if I pick up that phone and ain't nobody on that phone, I'm walking out of here today and I'm not going to work anymore and you're not going to deduct any money from my check. And he said, that's fair enough. I picked up that phone, ladies and gentlemen, and it was my mom on the phone. She said, I heard you don't drink no more. I want to see you. Boy, I have to tell this part. I didn't say anything at all. I hung the phone up, I went in the bathroom and locked the door, and I cried for a long period of time. It had been so long since I seen my mom. When I got off from work that afternoon, I left work running. I didn't have a car at the time, and I used to ride the bus. I couldn't wait on the bus that day. The bus was too slow. I had to go. Boy, and I don't know, when I got to my mom's house, man, oh, I never played in a basketball game or a baseball game where I sweated that much. I was wet all over. I wanted to see my mom so bad. And my life started to turn. Then I knew. I knew that you guys knew what you was talking about then. You know, and I knew another thing. I had started to look a little bit in the mirror. And so I talked to a man in the program about it, and he told me, he said, Pete, your self-respect is coming back. You getting one of the greatest things that you can get back is your self-respect. And I want to tell you something. My life took off, and they told me I needed to get active. I had 11 months and 3 weeks of sobriety, and you needed to have a year in order to get on the institution committee. One of the gentlemen that just passed away, Lee May, Bob and Ruth Filas, carried me to the institution committee. And this institution chairman didn't want to let me on. Jesus Christ, make him wait another week. He can't wait another week. And Lee said, no, let him on now before we might lose him. So the guy said, oh, well, maybe we'll bend the rules a little bit and let him on. And they asked me about the meeting. And they said that there were a gentleman that had the meeting in Bark Detox, was very ill, very ill. And he was just holding on to the meeting until we get someone to replace him. And they gave me that meeting. I didn't take that meeting, they gave it to me. Well, after they gave it to me, I've been there 22 years on Sunday night. And I'm gonna tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, to be in that detox and every other Sunday night, I usually see somebody that's been in this program. And I still get sad. I still get the lumps in the throat. Sometimes the tears in the eyes come up. You know, that let me know that if I don't continue to do what I am doing, I will be back there too. Many years ago, let me go back a little bit. Many years ago, a lady named Ruth Hollister, I'm sure that a lot of you old-timers might know, Ruth Hollister took control of my life. She was in the program. Ruth Hollister became my first sponsor. Now, that's not suggested, you know, for a man to have a lady sponsor, but at that time, the Big Bad Wolf, I didn't have the courage to ask nobody to be my sponsor. Ruth Hollister took me on, and she sponsored me, man, and she told me what to do. And her words were, Pete, there isn't anything on this earth that God can't do and won't do. You got to show him you want it. That's the way she used to say it. You got to show him you want it. You got to show him that you deserve this. Now, this is what I need you to do. I need you to get on your knees every morning and ask him to keep you away from a drink for that day. You get through that day, I need you to get back down that night and give him thanks. Huh? And you ain't got to have no long, drawn-out prayer or anything like that. You're just giving thanks and you're honoring God. And I started that, ladies and gentlemen, and my life just took off. Thing was just, and after so many years, I found out I didn't want that job anymore. So I had orders before I make any major decisions in the program to ask another alcoholic about it. I went to this man and I told him, I said, I don't want to be here. I don't want this job anymore. He said, what you want to be then, Pete? I said, I want to be a trucker. He said, well, you know what you have to do. You have to do first thing first. You have to get the license. Huh? Then you have to find somebody maybe to let you take the test in. You know, use their truck to take the test in. It was kind of complicated during that time. And now we have those CDL licenses, you know what I mean? They took all the old chauffeur licenses and things up, and you got to have these commercial driver's license today. And I said, I want to drive big trucks. I said, that's been one of my dreams ever since when I was little. I used to sit in a pecan tree in Georgia eating pecans, and I was right at the bottom of a big bridge. It was a pecan orchard there, and these truckers would be coming into town, and they'd gear these trucks down, and I used to like the sound of it, and the big tires rolling on the road, you know. The sound got to me, you know, and that diesel engine pumping, you know. And one of my family friends got a job at a cotton gin, and he was driving one, and once in a while, he would let me go to these different towns with him to deliver this cotton and stuff. And I said, that's what I want to do. So that's what I do today, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a truck driver, and I want to tell you something. When you're a truck driver, you spend a lot of time alone, and the mind can play tricks on you. Huh? I remember once I was way up by Jupiter and saw this billboard side the road. You remember that commercial about that Busch beer where that horse would rear up and you could hear the crack of that can? You know, I'm way up there, and there's one of them big things on the Busch beer where that stallion pumping up and this guy pulling on the can of beer, and the mine kicked right back in. Now you pull this big sucker over up here to this next truck stop, and you can go in there and have you a cold one. Nobody gonna know we're out here. You should have guessed what I told my mind. I laid a cursing on my mind like you wouldn't believe. No, I'm not going for this no more. And then things started to happen, and my life turned around. And then one day, ladies and gentlemen, something happened. Something happened, was devastating in my life. My wife, the day I was dating during that time, and I started to cough. And I hope she doesn't mind me saying this. My wife's a nurse, and I started to cough, and she told me, that's not a natural cough. You need to have that looked at. And you know, us drunks, what does she know? She don't know what she's talking about. You know, a couple of days later, early in the morning, brushing my teeth, man, I coughed up a chunk of blood. And I immediately got on the phone. And she said, what color was the blood? I said, what do you mean what color was the blood? It was blood. She said, was it bright or was it dark? I said, it was real bright. She said, you need to see a doctor. And I went to the doctor. Later on, I got sick first. I wouldn't go. Later on, I got sick and I went to the hospital. And they took x-rays of my lungs. Guy said, you okay? I don't know why you're coughing. Maybe you smoke too much. 3 days later, this is God working in my life, I know it was. 3 days later, I got sick and I had to go back to that same hospital. The guy says, I want an x-ray of his lung. One of the guys there, he said, I just took an x-ray of his lung 3 days ago. He said, I want another one. Do it. And the guy took it and he said, now this is what I was looking for. And he called him in the room. He said, you see how the lungs are clear here? He said, yeah. He said, well, look at these. Do you see that's clear? He said, oops. There was a spot there. He said, I think this lung cancer. I want you to take these x-rays and I want you to get a second opinion. Well, after I went through all this stuff and I went, asked my girlfriend then at that time, would she go with me? This guy called my job and asked me to come to his office. I knew something was wrong then. And when I went up there, he said, Pete, I'm sure this lung cancer, but I want you to take these x-rays and go see another doctor. Well, I had a doctor, I had a friend at that time, he's retired. He was a surgeon at Northridge Hospital. I had no appointment and nothing. I just walked in his office, walked right past the nurses and everything. Man, I was so scared. I didn't know what I was doing. I was going out of my mind. And the lady was, Mister, you can't go back there. Please, hold it. You need an appointment. And I saw him coming down the hall, and he said, what's wrong? I said, I need you to look at these. He took them out right there in the hall and looked at them. He said, I didn't have to even put this on the x-ray light. I can tell you what this is. It's lung cancer, Pete. Go in there and sit down. And I went in that room, and I'll tell you something. All the fear, all the every negative thing in the world came by me except one thing. Taking a drink didn't come. Dying just kept flashing in my mind. That was my payday. And as a truck driver, at that time, I was getting paid once a month. And I had picked up my check. I had a full paycheck in my pocket. I had never went to the bank and deposited any money or anything. And he says, there's a thing called exploratory surgery, where we go in and look around. And he said, you know, I'm a surgeon. If you give me permission to do it, I'm also going to ask you to give me permission to do whatever I think is necessary while I'm in there, so you don't have to go through two surgeries. And I signed those papers, and I went to Northridge Hospital. And they did the surgery. And when I came to in the recovery room, something real good happened to me. When I woke up in that recovery room, hard to breathe, but all these tubes and lights and things flashing in there, I didn't know what was going on. I heard a voice, kept saying, I got to see him, and kept hearing this other person say, you can't see him. And this man, I insist on you letting me. The guy said, you can't see Pete. The only people can see Pete at this point is his immediate family. And this guy said, I'm his brother. And this guy said, say what? See, I'm his brother. He said, well, in that case, go ahead. It was Bud Odewine, oh, God rest his soul, ladies and gentlemen. He came in and he brought me something. I wear it around my neck today. He gave me this. And he said it was a Canadian cross. And he said, you're going to be all right. I know it. You're going to be all right. And turned and left the room. That little bit did something for me. It was just what I needed. God knew exactly what I needed. And when they took me back in the room after a few days, the surgeon came in and said, Pete, you are a lucky man. I said, what do you mean? Am I dying? He said, no. He said, I think the cancer just had started in that lung, and I didn't take a chance. I took the whole lung out. You got one lung. And he said, I think you can live now if you don't go back and smoke and destroy the other one. I'm cancer-free today, ladies and gentlemen. That was in 1990. Don't tell me that isn't the power greater than yourself on this earth. And I know how he works. It's been working in my life. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about marriage. I wouldn't get married for nothing. I've been married once. I was married once. Married a second time. And I want to tell you something. I'm married to a lady that's just like I am. We are willing to work on our relationship. That's what you have. To be married to another human being, you have to work on that relationship. You can't sit down and say, I got it made. You know, in the big book, it say, I'm the head of the household. That don't mean I run everything. Huh? That's where a lot of men get this thing wrong, you know. But I run everything. I don't run everything in my house. You understand me? I don't run into him. My wife is just as equal as I am. She's got just as much say-so as I say in my life. I got that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had that old attitude, I'm the boss. I pay the cost to be the boss. I told her that one day, and she said, make my day, you know. No, my life is good today. My little granddaughter there. I just made reservations for us to go to Disney World. I've never been to Disney World. Never been to Disney World. I take a 4.5-year-old kid to Disney World alone. See, I'm a Toys R Us kid. You know, you heard that commercial during Christmas time, I don't want to grow up, I'm a Toys R Us kid. Well, that's me. Huh? I'm a 66-year-old baby. Huh? I love Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. Huh? And I'm going to be up there running just as fast as she is. You understand me? Having fun. This is what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had done to me. So when I made this reservation, I told this guy I wasn't familiar with what I was doing. He said, let me set up a package for you. And then I'll tell you at the end what the package would cost you. So after he set up everything, and I said, what the package would cost? He said, well, Mr. Cherry, I hope this isn't too much. When he told me what it was, I said, ain't no problem. He said, oh, good. Huh? You see, today, Alcoholics Anonymous have trained me to live like a human being. Huh? When I get paid, I have to take care of Pete first. Before I pay any bills, Pete come first. See, Ruth Hollister trained me this way. She said, if you make a dollar, I want you to save a dime. That's what she said. And I've been following directions of people in this program for many years. When I started off in this program, I started off with Stu and a whole bunch. Oh, we went to a lot of meetings together down at the 12-step house. It's a lot of people here I know tonight that means a lot to me. We go back a lot of years together when I started in this program. I wanted to run because I was black and I didn't see any other black people around. And one day I ran up on Harvey and the man just passed away, Lee. They were sitting, waiting on the men's meeting at the 12-step house. And they came over and they said, Pete, something wrong with you. And I said, yes, it is. I said, tell me something. Where is the black people? Is there any more black people? And he said, no. Lee said, you it. You the fly in the milk, baby. Ain't no more, huh? And I was so scared, you know, that they were going to call me that name and I was going to leave. But it never happened. And again, I know that was God working in my life. One of my best friends today was just as prejudiced as I was. See, I was born in the state of Georgia. I was telling Chuck I was born in the state of Georgia many years ago, and I was born during that time when the Ku Klux Klan was real active. You know, those people can put a lot of hate in you. But when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, something happened. Huh? Something happened to me. I walked around, you know, like Martin Luther King made that great speech about you walk around hating a whole race of people because of the color of their skin. Huh? I was one of them people. But one time I listened to that speech when I got sober and it made sense. He said, you don't judge a person by the color of their skin. You shouldn't judge them at all, but if you need to judge them by the content of their character. John Carney, Stuart, Mel, Joe, and Jim, I need to say this just the way it is, was the first white men I ever loved. And there's a lot of them in here now I love, truly love, in this room. When I walk in the room, when I came in today, I didn't see a bunch of white people. I saw a bunch of people. That's what the program does for me. Huh? It takes all this negative stuff away from me. Many years ago, when you approached me, I would immediately determine if you was white, if you were German, if you were Spanish, if you were something else. It don't matter no more. My life is good. I was free. That is one of the greatest freedom in the world, to lose that desire to be prejudiced, walking around hating people because of the color of their skin. I feel good about myself. This program has given me so much. You know, I go to church on Sundays. The program says, you know, it's up to you. If you have a religious belief, you can go back and practice it. I go to church on Sunday, and I go to the altar and pray. You know what mainly I pray? My life is so good, it gets scary sometimes. Black people used to have a superstition saying you get real lucky before you die. Huh? They get real scary sometimes. Everything is going so good. I'm not arguing with the wife, huh? And things are going good, huh? I had a little spat with my supervisor, you know, but it's turning around. I used to would handle this physically. What happened? I would have handled it physically. But now, Ruth Hollister used to always tell me, give God first chance. If you give God first chance, and you can come up with the patience and the tolerance to wait on him, you can see the results of these things. I'm seeing the results of this man. I was going to retire from my job because of his actions. I got called from big supervisors way up top. One of them, in fact, told me, you ain't going nowhere. We'll straighten this out. You know, that's the way my life goes today. The steps that they read, I try to practice them. I can't get them right. I can't get them right. But I try to practice them, and I think God knows this. We come in this program, and we're trying to do this stuff. We don't get it right, because I got a feeling that if we all figured we'd get it right, we'd walk out of the door and would never come back. But I ain't got this right. But I'm interested in learning more. After being sober for a little over 23 years, I'm still, it's a lot I got to learn. And it's a lot more I'm willing to learn. I'm just learning, I mean really, really, really learning how to love another human being and how to respect another human being and how to accept their love and their respect. My life is so good. I like to close my speeches with a thing I learned from a lady at the Big Book Seminar, Willie B. You know? And Willie B said a little thing that she learned, and I try to pick it up, and it's, God, let everybody treat me tomorrow the way I treat them today. Thank you, and God bless all of you.
Well, this concludes the first annual Westside Men's Group Fellowship Breakfast. My Vision Audio, Chuck, was gracious enough to record the entire proceedings today, so he's going to have the tape of this proceeding available.
Tape and CD.
Tape and CD. Immediately after, right?
Immediately.
Immediately after this show. So if you'd like to buy this, they'll have that available, as well as some other items over here. The entire Westside Men's Group would like to thank you all for your support and your patience today. We hope you enjoyed yourselves, and we look forward to seeing you all again next year. And please bring a friend. We'd like to give one more round of applause to Pete. That was just outstanding. And thank you all for coming. Good day. I'm sorry, we do have a nice way of closing if you'd like to join us.